Hello.
Three teachers and one student.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Disketten eller kassettelaufwerken.
Also die Vorteile.
Ja, ja, ja. Ja, ja, das sind die Magnete. Ja, ja.
Ja, ja, das
die Ehre, so die Ehre, genau.
Die ist, wo wir die Sticks haben,
oder? Ja, 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 genau.
Ja, ja, genau.
Und da die Rios, die Karton.
Ja, genau. 5¼ Zoll ist die
Zeit. Ja, genau. Da habe ich gemeint, oh, alles von Disketten mit 1,4 Megabyte. Das ist zu dem Zeitpunkt noch gewesen, wenn es eine Bildbearbeitung, also wenn du es, sagen wir, ein A4-Bild, ja, nicht mal A4, das kleiner ist es auch.
Aber ja, das andere Dinge, was man die Heavy braucht, ist das kann ich gehen. Aber
ich glaube, wir haben uns gewusst.
Ja,
das ist schon
damals
gesehen. Das ist schwierig.
Das ist krass, das sind jetzt irgendwie 40 Jahre und jetzt wird alles aufzugehen.
Oh, je nachdem, was man macht,
ja,
nicht,
ja, aber
die Ansprüche sind natürlich auch anders.
Ja.
Nein,
also
ich glaube, das nicht da. Nein, weißt du, ich laufe eben um.
Aha.
Weißt du, wenn ich das Zeugs hole? Also, es geht, glaube ich, nur ums Ich glaube, hören tun sie mich schon, aber wegen der Aufnahme wäre es wahrscheinlich besser, wenn...
Yeah, it should also work with that, I suppose. We can give it a try now if that is charged.
Yeah, voilà.
Ah, okay.
Do you mean to make not a reservation, the cozy class has three. What happened? Okay.
Tomorrow,
what is tomorrow?
We will have the exam.
And so what?
Starting out, yes.
Okay. And what kind of exam?
12 hours.
The 12 hours.
Yeah, which course? Let's start. I also sent out an email this morning, kind of wrapping up where we are. We are approaching the final lecture sessions. So the two lectures of today are confirmed. Then the last remaining ones next week, I still wait for confirmation from Philip, even though he has confirmed a couple of weeks back. But I assume it works fine. So I have a backup plan if he's not answering. But I'm confident that it will be as planned. Then, once again, deadline for the coursework. And in Blackboard, I also provided the assessment criteria on which the assessment will take place. Then the last information was about the oral exam with the dates. So I made a reservation for 3 days. Perhaps only 2 days are necessary. And then, as I also mentioned in the mail, the sequence for the candidates will be randomized. So very soon you will receive a personal mail where you find the time slot. The room is booked, that is down in the basement in AO 13. And very important, it takes only place physically on campus. Then regarding the content, as I mentioned to Dimitri, I can announce later a kind of a sum-up session where we briefly go through all the different inputs in terms of lectures we have had. But I encourage you to be active in Blackboard, go through the lecture notes and nevertheless the recordings. And
once again, if you look at the course title, it is mentioned Introduction to Research in Color Visual Computing. And the term introduction is a kind of indicating also the level. So we have scratched on the surfaces from different subjects, different research activities in the color lab. And that is what the oral exam is about. And definitely there is a question on contrast. But I will announce another meeting or a class where we can talk about them. But there is still 4 or 5 weeks to go. So that's okay. Then after the deep learning session yesterday, the upcoming second part of the deep learning this afternoon, we are going a little bit back in time and from digital into some analog stuff, and I'm very happy to have David Pfluger here. He has a PhD in physical chemistry in spectroscopy back in 2002. But you have for many years experience with analog and digital cinema post-production, and that is the topic, introduction to video and media, that will be the topic of today. So I'm very happy to have you here. And if you just could start with a brief introduction about what you are doing on a daily basis before you dig into the lecture.
That okay, sure. Very nice. Thanks. Yeah, hi everyone. You may recognize I have a similar English as Peter, because I'm also from originally, like he, from Switzerland. So I made a PhD in chemistry and kind of found out it wasn't totally what I wanted to do, and cinema seemed more exciting, so I went into cinema post-production. I was lucky to get a job there, and that was around the time when there was the conversion to digital. And so it was kind of a totally new world to me, and I learned a lot about analog and digital media. And from there, I kind of ventured, instead of becoming a well-known cinema director, I went into media preservation, meaning the conservation and keeping up the accessibility of old films and video. And just to start, so you're going to hear an introduction to video today. And maybe starting off with this kind of an image. So roughly 40 years ago in the 1980s, when you were dealing with video, you would have a setup like on the top, on the left, a CRT screen, a tube screen, something you may or may not have come across, and a video player and a videotape. And in more or less in the professional and in the non-professional area, you would have a similar size of gadgets. And on the bottom, you see a modern setup with a professional video player, which is kind of used for the advertising, for the screens you see. So there's no button to play or stop. It's just a player which you plug in and then it runs, and you can program the time when it shuts off or whatever. And it's kind of almost hidden. Here, this is the medium, so a micro SD card by now. And I mean, when we probably look at the setup at your homes, the way you consume video, you would probably just have the screen because you're streaming the stuff. So you kind of got rid on a daily basis of all these gadgets here. So What is video? First, to talk about it, we need to know what it is, and it's actually not so easy to define. It's often a contrast we often talk about film and video, and film is kind of the classic strip with the images on it. And video, you may think of something like this, but then this is also video. So is it now magnetic or optical? Is it analog or digital? So, and the definition of video is actually goes via the fact that you have an electronic signal and you don't see the images like this. You can only see it via a playback equipment. So video kind of is defined through how it is played back. And I'm going to pass these through so you can have a look if you don't know these. So if you open, you can actually open the, by pushing this button, you can open and see the videotape, and you will never see an image on the videotape. Or by,
is this the movie Halloween?
Or possibly, maybe the trailer. Okay. This is also a videotape, a bit older one, and also here you don't see any images. Okay, it's magnetic or optical, but in a way that it's not visible. And in the production, it has not been. It's not a photographic medium. So we have kind of two components to it. We have on the signal side, we can have an analog or a digital signal. And on the carrier side, we have magnetic, optical, or other carriers. And we have also something which I call a dedicated or non-dedicated media, which I'm going to explain later what I'm talking about here. So video is kind of defined through the signal level, the carrier level, and naturally also the content level, but this is more like on the side of how is video usually used and how is film used in the audiovisual world. And I'm not going into that subject today. So apparently you can see this here, and maybe you've also come across video formats. So there's a lot of different video formats. And the question is, why are there so many? Couldn't they, you know, just make one type of videotape which everybody could use? But naturally, there are several arguments why there are so many different video formats. On one hand, there's the technical evolution, and as technology advances, you will want to have the same information on a smaller space, or you change from analog to digital, and that kind of gives rise to new formats. You have a competition between companies. One company brings out one format and the other one another one, and they compete against each other. So what is this? Does anybody?
It's a VHS.
VHS, okay. What is this? No, it was the concurrence product to VHS by Philips. And VHS was more popular and made the market. And this went down after a few years. So this is Video 2000. Actually, my dad still had a Video 2000 tape. So he picked the wrong one and had to buy a VHS. And also Sony put out a concurrence product. This is Betamax. But you don't know these because they never were widespread. But they are from different companies, different formats, which they put on the market, and one makes the race and the others don't. And there's also backwards compatibility may be a factor in the rise of formats, and also the demands for different applications. So If you take a professional videotape, nobody at home would want a videotape like the big reel you have there or such a big cassette. So for at home, we try to have smaller formats and with a lower quality. But for professionals, the size doesn't play so much of a role. Also, the cost. Naturally, such a tape would be much more costly. And then you would have different formats for professional and amateur use. So also saying, I've been already profusely using the word format is kind of a very widespread term to use. So in maybe when you're using it in a professional context, try to clarify what you mean by format. So there's video format, tape format, data format, etc., etc. So when you're just talking about format, nobody knows if you mean the shape, if you mean the signal, or whatever you're talking about. So just saying, try to be on a professional level, try to be clear what you're talking about. So basically, the moving image, independent of film or video, is made up of certain parameters. And the main parameters are the dimension or the image resolution. This is often talked about, you know, HD, UHD television. So this is one aspect of the image which we perceive strongly in our daily lives. The second thing would be the running speed. A film usually runs at 24 frames per second, a video at 25, but there were also other aspects we're going to see. And then so you could say this is the resolution in space, number one. The second one is the resolution in time, how many single images you have per second. And you also have a resolution in the color, which is probably going to be the part of it which you know best. So just quickly, the resolution in space is basically how big are the pixels, how dense are the pixels, and naturally you can find in the audiovisual area, you can find some standards. So there's the standard definition format, the high definition format, etc., etc. In the analog, this also looks, I kind of faked, I wanted to fake the analog grain, but it looks very bad. It looks very digital. Anyway, so also in the analog world, you have something like a resolution. So on film, if you have a lot of grain, you see less detail. So often there is like comparable features in the analog and the digital world. And another thing about I have kind of this slide with the beware sign, just showing you some a little bit complex or things that are easy to be misunderstood. So when we talk, I'm sure you've heard about 4K cinema. And the problem is that this 4K as a term means something different depending if you are in the classic cinema world, in the home TV world, or in the digital cinema world. So when we used to digitize motion picture film, like there is one going around, this is usually a 4x3 image, and when we say we digitize it in 4K, we mean 4096 by 3072 pixels, and it's a 4x3 aspect ratio. Now, when somebody sells you a 4K TV, he or she means something different. There, it's also equal to the term UHD, and it's 3040 times 2160 pixels. Then when we go to the cinema, and we are in a digital cinema, the one you have here in Gjøvik is kind of a 4K projector, then it's still something else. It's 4,096 times 2,160. And here you see it's kind of interesting. The analog cinema and the video world kind of merged into each other through the fact that everything's becomes digital. And you have kind of a funny compromise between the height of UHD and the width of the digital film format. But when it comes to the aspect ratio, you have still something completely different. So when talking about 4K, it can mean different things. Beware. Another aspect which makes things a bit difficult is the fact that there's something called non-square pixels. So when you have an image stored on your computer, usually you have an aspect ratio and a certain amount of pixels. And you're used to the fact that the image is displayed in a correct way when you have square pixels. But in the audiovisual domain, there is always the problem. We have a lot of information we want to store on a small space. And so we're looking for ways to save data. And one way to save data is if you have an HD image, which is in principle 1920 to 1080, a 16 by 9 aspect ratio, you just store it as 1440 times 1080, and it's horizontally squeezed. And once you display it, you just stretch it out. Naturally, that has a consequence to the quality of the image, so the horizontal definition is not as high as the vertical definition, but you can save a lot of data that way. So this is just one of many ways to kind of save data. And actually, this has already been used in the analog cinema. So actually, the cinema reel you have in your hands is of the CinemaScope format. And already there, they wanted a wider aspect ratio of the image. So what they did, they just squeezed it horizontally by filming through a special lens. So this was a purely analog process. You, instead of a spherical lens, which gives you a regular display, it would give a horizontal contraction, put it on the film, and in the projector you just do the stretching horizontally and you get this wide image. So again, we have kind of a mirroring of analog techniques which found their way into the digital technique, and the aim was the same. We have limited space, be it space on the film strip or data space, and we try to do something bigger with it. Now, from the size of the image, moving to the resolution in time. So there are naturally many ways to kind of display a movement. And if you have like a regular, what we called regular, which is always a standardized frames per second, this will be usually, for film, it will be 24 frames per second. For video, it will be 25 frames per second. And we have other standards. We have 50i, which I'm going to explain in a minute. So we have different standards of various speeds, and we have different standards because of the historical evolution of the medium. So in the film world, they kind of found out if you have 24 frames, it's kind of a visually continuous display in cinema, so that is a good speed. In the video world, they decided for 25 frames per second, which is kind of weird, because, come on, why this difference of one frame per second? But actually, the reason for it is that video, the frequency of video is heavily connected to the frequency of our current. So we have 50 hertz on our power supplies, and in that sense, that's why there's 50i as an image frequency in video, which I refers to half images. As I said, I will explain this, and that's 25 full images. Now, when you go to the US or maybe also some of the countries you come from, you don't have 50 hertz, you have 60 hertz. Consequently, they are dealing with 60i and 30 frames per second, full frames per second. So you can already see there are some standards, but there is quite a lot of different standards, and it can be quite confusing. So talking about these half images, also called interlaced. So there's a difference between progressive images and interlaced images. Progressive images is the thing you're probably used to nowadays. If it's 25 frames per second, 25 times, you get a full image on your screen. That is what our technology today is capable of. But at the time, and that was in the 1930s when television was developed, they had naturally much more limited possibilities, and everything was analog. And their problem was how to bring so much information 25 times on the screen per second. And they couldn't do it. So let's say their bandwidth was too small. So they had to find a way to display the image with a smaller bandwidth, but a continuous flow. And what you can see here, what they did, they didn't display 25 full images per second, but they would make half images, meaning a half image is every second line. And then you would write the image like this, as a continuous stream, first line 1, 3, 5, etc., and then the line 2, 4, 6. And in total, they had 576 lines. And they were divided in two batches, two half images, and they were displayed like this. And the thing is, you know, the technology advanced to go beyond this technically. We were quite soon able to do it in another way, but because it was already a standard and so many people had TV sets working that way, they wouldn't change the standard. They would stick to this interlaced medium. And even the digital videotapes like DV, I'm sure you heard of it, they still had the interlaced video standard. And even HD video, the full HD 1920x1080, would have first come out in an interlaced and in a progressive standard. So kind of something that was rooted in the 1940s, 50s, due to the technological level, would then have consequences into the 2000s. And just about the notation, you will often see a notation in the video world, which is, for instance, 1080i. And 1080i refers to this full HD, 1920x1080, so the 16:9 aspect ratio, at interlaced scan, what I just explained to you. And 1080p would say the HD resolution in progressive scan, full images. And to the contrary, and this notation is kind of focused to the amount of lines. And this is again a historical thing, because they had 576 lines in the video image early on. And when you go to digital, it's kind of clear every line is going to be a vertical pixel line. Video is very focused on this resolution by line, and the resolution horizontally is just then the consequence of the aspect ratio. And in the film world, it's the other way around. You were limited by the width of the film. So when we talk in film about 4K, then we talk about the width, not the amount of, not the heights of the image. So there's kind of these two worlds, and as we've seen before, then flow together in digital cinema, and that then it becomes kind of complex. Okay, are we talking now about this 4K or that 4K?
So in the I 1080, the I stands for interlaced.
Interlaced, yeah. And P is for progressive. Why the full frame is called progressive, I don't know. So these nomenclatures often are not totally logical or intuitive.
What did you say? Why the full frame is called progressive? The full frame is, you mean the format of 36 by 24 millimeter?
No, not the spatial full frame, but the fact that you display a full frame every time. So not an interlaced scan. Why progressive? I don't know. If anybody finds out, send me an email. I'd like to know.
But it could be the progress of the top down of filling this image, because it was anyway top down in the image.
Yeah, but... You mean the progression of continuously filling the image instead of interlaced where you do... Yeah, okay, maybe. That sounds quite reasonable. So as I said, there are interlaced standards for certain formats and for others are not. For instance, when HD came to the market... Sony stuck to what we call now full HD, which is 1920 times 1080. But Panasonic thought, okay, we're going to make a compromise. We're making a smaller HD, but we can have smaller tapes, and that it's going to be 1280 times 720. And Sony said we're going to make an interlaced and a progressive standard, but Panasonic only opted for a progressive standard. So these HD tapes by Panasonic take the smaller HD and they're only progressive, and the Sony standard is a different one. So we are in a world where many standards kind of are created by companies, and then they get common or they don't get common. What you can see here is kind of a typical effect when you go from an interlaced image to a progressive screen. So we have a lot of media which were recorded interlaced, and now we want to display them on the modern equipment. And when you look at a single image where these half images are combined, one of the aspects of this half image is that if you have a movement, because the half images were recorded one after the other, there's also another phase of the movement in these half images. And then when you combine them, you have kind of the two stages of the movement in there. If something is static, like the background, you don't see it. But in the movement, you see kind of this comb effect, like combing your hair, because there is like these lines which are from this interlaced structure. And often, as a result, there's a process applied called deinterlacing that may also be something you've heard of. And deinterlacing means that you get rid of this effect. But most of these calculations of deinterlacing also mean that you're losing information. So when processing images in a deinterlacing, often you have also the effect that you lose some definition. And, you know, with these old SD images, the definition usually is already bad enough, so it gets even worse. The third aspect of the moving image is the definition of the color, so the resolution of your color. I'm guessing these are you're familiar with this bit depth stuff, so I'm not losing too much time on it. So you can also have in the color channels, you can have a certain resolution, and you can see it in the image. This effect in the sky, that instead of having a smooth sky, you have kind of these steps of the colors. In the video world, you call it banding. And this is something, for instance, maybe you've seen DVDs, and in DVDs the bit depth is relatively low, and in the skies you can often see these banding effects, or in smooth transitional colors you can see these banding effects. Just quickly about these concepts of color display. Usually in video we're dealing with RGB. In film, interestingly, sometimes we deal with RGB and sometimes with the CMY color scheme. One other thing which is very typical to video and kind of interesting is that there is video, professional video, which uses a red, green, and a blue channel. But they had a problem when they introduced color television. Most people already had a TV, and it was black and white. And today they will probably say, buy a new one. But at the time, they were kind of respecting that people had paid a lot of money for their TV. So they needed a signal which could be read by a color TV and a black and white TV alike. And what they did a color conversion from RGB to Y. In analog, it's YUV. YCBCR is the digital version of it. Meaning, in one channel, you have the luminance information, and in the two other channels together is the complete color information as a different signal. So if you have a color TV, your TV reads all the three channels which come in and decodes it and displays it again as RGB. And when you have a black and white TV, your TV just ignores the two channels, different signal channels which contain the color and reads the black and white image. And like this, you have a system which works for both. And also this was rooted, as you can see, in a kind of technological fact of the 50s or 60s, but it's still the system is still being used. So from YUV in the analog world, we would move on to YCBCR, and then there's also YPR, etc. So there's many different ways this is being displayed or encoded, the details of which you know probably in the end better than me.
We can just say that the R, G, and B components are contributing with specific weights to the Y, CB, and CR in this case. And basically, it's, in the end, it's a 3x3 matrix that determines for each of the destination channels in the YUV or YCB, CR primaries.
And anyway, I mean, all the colors you see on this side, these are monochrome images. These are black and white images as they are transmitted. And this different signal is not a signal you would look at under any circumstance. So this is just a kind of showing how the data looks, but finally, on your color TV, what you see is RGB. So this YUV or YCBCR is just a transmission code which solves a technical problem. And also here, I'm just quickly touching this, naturally there would be a color space to each of these systems, which is also defined by a standard. So we have in standard definition TV, we have this REC 601 color space. And as you can imagine, in Europe we have the PAL system, in the US we have the NTSC system. And not only the frequency and the resolution is different, also the color space is different. So it was normal for me when I was young, I could not order a VHS from the US and play it on my player. So we also have this with the DVDs, but that's because an enforced regional code, it's not a technical aspect. It was not technically possible, even though the cassette looked identical, to play the VHS from the US in Europe. And within that, the aspect that the color space were different in the two systems was probably the smallest problem. And then when we go to digital cinema or HD, we have the REC 709. And for digital cinema, we have the DCI-P3. And in Gjøvik, you even have the REC 2020 color space in your cinema. So you're very advanced. Actually, Norway was one of the first countries which, from a government side, kind of not enforced, but heavily supported the conversion from analog to digital cinema. So I would say all over the world, most cinemas have probably a 2K DCI-P3 standard, but a few privileged people have already the REC 2020 4K standard. So one thing I want to convey here is that a lot of the audiovisual world works via these standards which define speed, color, definition. And these standards are not necessarily thought out by some kind of a standard body, and then they say, okay, we do it that way. But it comes via companies putting to market a certain format. And if this format wins against the competitor's format, then this becomes a standard. And then also other companies start to apply these standards. So, for instance, digital Betacam was invented by Sony. It became a de facto standard. And you can also buy a DigiBeta tape from Fuji or from other companies. But the big buck also through the right situation is being made by Sony, and that's also why they are so interested to kind of define the use standards. Okay, taking all of this together, so here is an overview of this all of these aspects of the moving image, and then when you go to a certain format, you can say, okay, the PAL format, standardized by the ITUR standardizing body under this number, is analog. It is in standard definition. It has 50 interlaced frequency. It is a 4:3 display aspect ratio, which in the in an analog format, there's no pixel aspect ratio, but there's something comparable to non-square pixel going on already there. We have YUV channels, we have a certain color space, and we have, in certain cases, something that can be called color subsampling in the analog world. The term also refers to something digital. So PAL is defined by a selection of properties. NTSC, what they're using in the US, I've mentioned it before, it's based on 60i, it has a different resolution, but it's also analog 4:3, etc., etc. So we're having kind of So when you have a videotape in your hand and you know this is DigiBeta, it will kind of define a selection of these properties. Then when we go from the analog to the digital world, we have these properties which are kind of which reference to the analog world, but which are then within a digital signal. And so, for instance, the DV standard kind of picked up on the properties of the analog image. And what they were also trying to do is kind of within the DV standard, you need to cover the US world with the 6DI. You need to cover the new standard of 16x9. And you need to cover also, you then have these additional digital properties like compression or color subsampling. So moving from one world to the other, you have some properties which are from the analog world and which parallel into the digital world, and you have some new stuff which you also like to put into the scope of such a format. So it gets quite complex. That means when you have a DV tape in hand, on one hand, you know what it is on the signal level, but on the other hand, there's still these substandards which may make your life easier or not so easy. And the same in HD cam, I'm not going through that. In high definition, you also have interlaced and progressive standards. It's now purely 16x9, etc., etc. So you've seen there's a lot of different shapes of these tapes and formats. I want you to tell me one of these are all tapes in the beta family of the Sony company. And you can see they all look the same. What's the advantage of that? The advantage is the mechanical system of putting a cassette into a player and ejecting it can be the same over all of these formats. Even though your player, one player, this is analog, digital, digital, digital. So there's an analog tape which has the same shape and look like a digital one. I have here these examples. So these are all different formats from the same company, and they decided to give it the same shape. Now my question to you is, which one of these cassettes is not a videotape? Right. DTF. So you can see it probably by the fact that it's written 200 gigabytes. But this points to another evolution of how data is stored in the audiovisual and generally in the world. So DTF, this is just the big cassette. They all exist in a bigger and a smaller cassette. DTF has the same format because it's also by Sony, but it's a data tape. So while with these, you can say there's going to be a video on it. On this one could be your taxes or whatever. So this is the difference which I call the difference between dedicated carriers and non-dedicated carriers. So on such a videotape, you can just put video. There might be some differences, PAL and TSC, but basically you know it's a video. You don't know what information is going to be on these because they're non-dedicated carriers. Also, your hard disk or your USB stick is a non-dedicated carrier because any information could be on there. And generally, we have been moving in the audiovisual world from the dedicated carriers to the non-dedicated carriers. And this makes some things easier, but some things also more confusing.
To the three Sony tapes.
Yeah.
So
can you use only one hardware type, or do you need then three different hardware types to be able to read all these three?
Initially, you needed three different players. But naturally, then Sony came up with this. The latest model would be one where you can play all of them with one player. So, because you can't do that when you have different shapes, the advantage was for Sony, okay, we now bring out a player and it can do all of it. But basically, you would need a separate player for each. And when talking about digitization and dedicated and non-dedicated media, I guess, do you know what that is?
Audio tape,
yeah. Everybody knows. You know what that is? Yeah, it looks like an audio tape, but it's a computer game. So on the Commodore 64, they would put computer games on tapes and it would take forever to load them, so it was not recommendable. But you can see, so there's kind of the idea to have, this is a dedicated medium in principle and this is a non-dedicated medium. For your computer, it could also be, as I said, maybe not your taxes on the C64, but I don't know, a speech simulator, whatever they had. So, in principle, when I divide between dedicated and non-dedicated carrier, we assume that they have a different shape. But in principle, you could take any of these to make a dedicated and a non-dedicated. You also had, well, here is one. The DVDs, which are purely video, dedicated carrier, but you also had the DVD-ROM where you could put anything you want. So there's kind of an overlap over in these worlds. But taking one and using it for another is kind of an old concept. And another concept is also backward compatibility. You probably don't know what this is, because I also didn't until not long ago. But what this is, the digital audio cassette by Philips. So, and they made them to be the same shape. So their idea was we introduce a digital tape that was probably in the 90s or so, and we can sell machines which can play the old ones and the new ones. You can play the new ones on the old cassette player, but at least you can still play your old cassettes. So their idea was we keep the shape and we make it digital. This also happened for VHS, so this is a digital VHS. It won't play on your regular VHS player, but on a specific machine, which probably could also play your analog. But these formats never made the market, so they died almost immediately after they were conceived. But on the other hand, Sony was very successful with using the same shape for different generations of media. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's kind of difficult. And companies invest a lot of money to, you know, conceive a new format, and when it goes down, they lose a lot of money. So the market is very competitive. Okay. So physical properties. You see that all these are bound to a cassette or a disc or anything. And you may say, okay, today we have the cloud. We just put it on the cloud. We don't need this. The movies I'm streaming. So what are you talking about? But still, naturally, every medium needs a carrier. And also what you are streaming is somewhere on a carrier. You just don't know where. So there's a certain danger with this cloud thing that maybe you remember MySpace kind of lost a lot of data, or Google deletes some work. So when you rely on an external carrier, you don't know where it is, you don't know how it's administered, You have certain advantages, maybe. It's easier to deal with. You can access from everywhere. But when you have your videotape at home, you have it in your hands, and it's bound to a carrier, and so you have only when you're the only one who's responsible when you lose it. So this idea of modern media don't have a carrier is kind of a bit an illusion. So somewhere there are huge data centers where all your data is stored. It's just not in your home. Just a quick word about how these physical entities are kind of being made. Generally, with the tapes, also with others, we have a plastic carrier. We have a plastic tape, usually it's polyester. Or with this disc, I'm not even sure what the plastic is. But on this plastic, you have an information layer where the information is stored. And then you have other layers, like to stick them together, or a protective layer, or to absorb UV light, etc., etc. So in principle, they are a multi-layer system. And usually, how it is exactly made is a company secret, and it's not open. So when you are into preservation and restoration, you often come to the problem. You can see, okay, this tape is decaying, but what is actually happening to it? And if you want to find out on a chemical level, you need to know what is actually in there. And companies are usually very secretive about it, even for sure at the time when they produce it, because it's a company secret, and later they lost the information. So a lot of information we would be very happy to have today to save media is actually been lost by the companies. And just briefly, so you can write information on a carrier in an analog way by carving a signal into plastic, or here in film with the silver grain, or by magnetic information made visible in the top image. And for the digital, it's not so much different. It's just a different signal. So instead of a varying signal, you just have dots. And here, to show you, it's not just about tapes. So you have these different discs, Blu-ray and CD-ROM and CD. And they are actually made up in a different way. So it's kind of interesting to know that in an audio CD, actually, the information layer is just underneath the sticker. So when you rip off the sticker in a bad way, you may damage the information layer. While in the DVD, it's a sandwich. While in the Blu-ray, it again works in a different way. So also, the manufacturing was adapted according to the technical needs, or also according because they learned maybe it's not so clever to make the information layer so accessible, so we try it in a different way in the DVD. And this is just this information on these three media as it gets smaller and smaller, and the smaller it gets, the more shortwave light you need to read it. So the Blu-ray is Blu-ray because it's a blue laser. Yeah, that's the size of the spot, reading spot.
Oh, wow. It's bigger than the 6
yeah, and you, bigger than the, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to leave it a certain margin of error also. And you can see the margin of error is naturally much smaller there. So, just a general information, because maybe you're not so interested in preservation of historical media. But usually with film, we have a lot of trouble with the fact that the plastic tape is going bad. It can shrink, it can become brittle, etc., etc. But most of the videotape formats have already been using polyester tape from an early time. And polyester is very time-resisting. So usually the layer, the information layer, is more of a problem. So on top, you see a film reel in decay, so this can look quite ugly. And you can see it sticks together or whatever, and you will never be able to play this film. And here in the case of a magnetic tape, the tape is totally okay, but the magnetic layer is coming off. And then in both cases, you're lost. And I have a nice example here of an audio CD, and you can look through it and see the damage. So also the plastic carrier is totally okay, but the information layer is falling apart. Just as a hint when dealing with different media. So we talk now a lot about technical properties of the image or of the carrier. But what is the consequence? The consequence is that the images you store, they look in a certain way according to the medium they're stored on, according to the standard. So, for instance, a film image has grain. So you can recognize a film image when you see it by the grain, and you can say this must be a motion picture film. And this is, it looks even worse than it actually looks. This is, for instance, typical for a VHS quality. And one thing you can also see here in this room, nobody would project VHS at this size. VHS we were looking at on this size. And then it looks much less like crap. But
this reconnection, as you can see, my friend, maybe it's nice sometimes to reconnect to things that we are daily exposed to. Also, these images on the phone, they look gorgeous on your phone. Sometimes can you display them bigger.
Yeah, and then you see all the compression artifacts and stuff. So when considering the quality of a medium, you also have to consider how was it shown at the time, on what equipment and in what size. And this is naturally of interest for cultural heritage preservation. This is a also standard definition image of Beta SP. Beta SP you've probably never seen. It's also a standard definition video, but you can see it has already much better, it already looks much better. And this is just an excerpt, but it's kind of, yeah, okay. You see a lot of compression artifacts as well, which you shouldn't. But film has the grain, so you can recognize the film image by the grain. And I can quickly play you something. Do we have audio here? Let's see.
Yeah, I think so.
Let's see. Yeah, it's still coming from here. Is there an audio? Yeah, anyway, let's lose not too much time here. But from the audio you've heard, what could you tell?
Maybe play it again.
Yeah, okay. How does this sound to you? Was this recorded yesterday? Okay, and on which carrier would you expect this to appear?
A vinyl or something like that? One of those like wax filters.
Okay, okay. In between, Vinyl is too modern, Wax Cylinder is too old. It's Shellac Records. These were the first vinyl type records, but it was another another plastic, and it gives kind of, you have a lot of things in there in this recording. You have the recording quality, which was not the same. You have the shellac record sound, and you have, you heard the clicking, which would say is probably not on the recording, it's a damage. And if it's a disc, the damage comes back if it's a scratch. So you, from the recording, you can say, okay, this was probably not a tape, but it was a record, etc., etc. So a kind of the recording identifies itself to be from a certain age and from a certain carrier. So I just wanted to demonstrate it's not only the images, it's also the sound where it's kind of, you can find this. And depending on who you are, looking at a certain image, you will say, okay, this is a film reel. But if you've never seen one, you will not identify it. So depending, if you've dealt, I've dealt a lot with VHS, I can identify immediately a VHS quality image. For you, it may be more difficult. So there is, in these mediums, is more than just an image. You may just be interested in the image content, but they carry much more about history of media, about history of technology, and about history of mankind, if I want to put it like that. And when we digitize it, we want to make sure that not only the image information is stored, but also all this metadata around around the physical appearance and the time, how it was perceived. Okay, there's also exceptions. Yes.
Just to shoot in, I mean, what you're talking about now is related to the storage of the information, but then there is also the kind of the art of the directive, for instance, of the content. I mean, we are not addressing that today, but there are different directors who has a certain preference. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the song which you just heard, it was also clear that it's not Lady Gaga. So also the content, or how a film is shot, or how the design aspects, etc., naturally also tell us a lot about its history. So it's kind of a pool of information you can take from an audiovisual element and say a lot of things, finally. But you need to have the context information, and you need to be able to read these signals. And I just want to show you a funny, there's actually not much to see, a funny exception to the rule. So when you see this, this is a vinyl record, there will be audio on it, right? And actually there is, but this this band actually put to the on the end of the inside groove, they put a Commodore 64 program. And I told you before that these programs also were on audio cassettes, so what they did, they just played the audio signal, which sounds like chaotic, like data when you hear it. They put it on the record. And so this record is now not just a dedicated audio record, it also is a non-dedicated, so to say, it's like a floppy disk. And naturally it's a bit difficult to read that back and make this program visible, but there's a few lines written in BASIC, was the thing at the time, and it's just a display of some clever citation by a bit of a funny choice by Albert Einstein and Jesus Christ. So this was kind of a Christian rock band. And they put kind of this secret program onto... Yeah. And actually, they gave a hint to this somewhere, you know, somewhere, sometimes bands would scratch some written information into the centering, and somewhere there is written C64, and then you would know, okay, you have to look for a C64 program. Maybe that was the Christian answer to backward playing devil's messages or whatever. So that was kind of in the en vogue at the time. So this is kind of, so most of the time you can rely on what you see is what you get. This is a videotape, I will have this and that signal, but there are also the exceptions where you get something completely different. And also in the artist world, naturally people would try a lot of things. So to the history, I'm not going deep into this, but one thing is important. Video recording is very closely connected to the history of television. And television at first was a live broadcast thing. So the first television programs, they were live broadcast and nobody recorded them, because it was just a unit where you could play into the camera on one end and look at what you're doing on the other end. And there was, initially, there was no recording system for that. And what I want to show you here is, this is kind of from a book from the 1880s. So 50 years before the invention of television, and they are talking about the telephonoscope. So that's how they imagined TV to be, 50 years before it was created. So we have our ideas of science fiction, flying cars, etc., etc. They had their ideas too, and they were not stupid. So they had the idea of the concept of a television already before even motion picture film was something that was a fact. So this guy, I mean, the size is not bad. We're not there yet, television of that size. The guy here is looking at the scene of a war, I think, happening in Peking in China. So very interesting. So how science fiction comes to be reality, and people always have fantasies about the future, and they already at the time were not stupid. And on one hand, the development of transmitting images is also very much connected to the technology of the tube, of the vacuum tube. And the vacuum tube was first invented also in the end of the 19th century, and it was naturally then developed on one hand to be a recording device, so this is a recording tube, and on the other hand to be a display device. So you had a tube on one end and you had a tube on the other end. And just saying, this is maybe a bit of a better representation of how the interlaced signal kind of works. So these phosphors here, when you hit them with an electron beam, they will start to glow, but they vanish again. So you have to reactivate them. So what happens in the interlaced image is exactly that. They start to glow and then slowly vanish while the writing of the image goes down. And this happens naturally so fast that you have the idea that you see a continuous image. And here on top is kind of a modern television vacuum tube. So going from something like this, or these are not particularly old, to something like this here. And there's also another thing. I said television, it was not for recording. In the beginning, television was recorded onto film, and films were projected into the system to, when they showed a movie on TV, they played it from a film, and then it was displayed on the screen before there were the first magnetic record. You have that tape somewhere. So this is, yeah. So this were kind of the first tape format, so there's no cassette yet. It's very wide because they were not able to store the information very densely, but that's how it looked in the beginning of television when they were able to start to record images on magnetic media. So we have all kinds. This is roughly in historical order. We start with open reel tapes, then there came the analog cassette tapes, then we have analog discs. Huh? Laser disc, does that tell you something? This is an analog DVD, so to say. So it's analog and it's read by a laser. It came out in the 80s or so. In Basel, where I lived, there was a store for this. So the cool people didn't have VHS, they had laser disc. And it was very expensive. And there were also several competitors on the market. There's this one. Imagine having a library full of these instead of your Mac Mini, where you're watching your streams. So this was these were also two competitors on the market. But these are not recording. These are just playing. Naturally, there were recorders, but that was not very common. The idea was that you buy a finished movie on a medium. While then with the analog cassette tape, you could naturally also record yourself. And then came the digital cassette. You've seen examples, the digital discs. And finally, all of these non-dedicated carriers recording to SD card, to SSD and HDD, etc., etc. I also have a few two posters here showing, you know, everything I couldn't take with me. So here you can see a chronological order of video recording techniques. And there's also online resource for identification if you have a tape or anything you can't identify. So let's check the time. How much time is left?
Yeah, I have forgotten the break. It was so exciting. So so normally we have until 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a call event for 12:15.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I propose to skip the break and
okay, yeah, if you can take it. I mean, now I'm sure you're very relaxed from looking at these things and you're not nervous about the test tomorrow.
After you reminded me.
Oh, yeah. Shit, no. Okay, let's move on. Okay, so we have naturally on those video players, we have different types of signals. And one type of signal was called the composite signal, where you had this one signal and the ground. That means all the color information, all the information had to go into one signal. Then you had a bit of better quality. Naturally, putting all the signals into one line, if you do it in an analog way, in a digital way, you can do it without loss of information. In the analog way, you would lose information. So this video signal was the worst you could have, VHS level. And then at some point, or in the semi-professional world, there would be S video. I think S stands for super. And what you have here, you have two signals plus the ground, naturally. And what they did here is kind of they divided between Luma and Chroma. So they didn't pack all three signals into one. They would use this YUV technique, and they would take the Y separately and the UV together. And there you had already a significant improvement in quality. And naturally, on the On the more professional level, you have all the three separated. You can see it here, YUV or YCBCR. So you have not the RGB signal in this instance, but this luminance-chrominance signal. And you may recognize on this unit also there's already HDMI. So or also in the modern world, when people produce projectors or machines which already have full digital capability, it may be of interest to still offer the analog options. There was also this beast of a cable, maybe you've seen that, SCART it was called, and there's a lot of pins and there are a lot of options. So you can see composite video output. So this was this worst video signal, but you can also see RGB red, green and blue. So you could also, in principle, you could transmit a very high quality signal with this cable. And you have also the audio in the same cable, which we also have like today with HDMI. Everything goes through one if you want. And there was the VGA cable. And just to show you, there is a particularity. You have red, green, and blue, and you have a horizontal and a vertical sync. So there were some video signals which didn't only have three for RGB. They had five because a synchronizing signal was also sent via a separate line. And then you ask me, okay, why it's one time RGB and one time they need the sync signal. In some signals, the synchronization was on top of the green channel. So you would just have RGB, but on the green channel, there would be an additional synchronizing signal on top of that. And sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. So it's kind of, again, there are different formats and you'd have to see what kind of a cable you need for your particular use case. So a ton of cables in the analog and the digital world. And I think tomorrow they will also, in the test, they will also ask you about these cables.
No. Thanks for the hint.
You can buy my slides for after the course. And just very quickly, so how does an analog signal look? If we just look at one line in the oscilloscope, we get something like this. And so there's a segment of the signal which is visible, and there's a segment of the signal which is not visible on your screen, but in there is additional information. So there's some explanation, no need to go into that, but there is, for instance, sadly it's cut off here, there's the horizontal sync. This burst signal was used to synchronize the colors in some way. And so you can see, and this is just one line. Huh? So there would be 576 of these in sequence will give you one image. And then when we move to digitization, how do we digitize properly this kind of signal? And as I've mentioned before, it comes in lines, in a certain amount of lines. So the vertical resolution is clear. One line of video gives one line of pixels, but horizontally we have an analog signal. And analog signals, you know, there's this big ongoing discussion at which resolution do you need to digitize motion picture film so you got really all the information. And because it's a chaotic analog structure, it's very hard to say, okay, where is the limit? Where are we doing too much? Where are we doing too few? And with video, interestingly, vertically, there's no question, but horizontally, we're also dealing with an analog signal. And for some reason, which honestly are not totally clear to me, there's an explanation, but 720 pixels for the horizontal width is kind of what was the conclusion. And this was the conclusion for NTSC and PAL. So in NTSC, you would also have 720 horizontally, but vertically you have only 480. So you have these non-square pixels in that sense that you have a funny aspect ratio on the pixel side, but then to look at it, you need to squeeze it into the correct aspect ratio. And on one side, in digitization, there's the signal side, but there's also the display side. And I find this quite interesting. Some gamers discussing about how their favorite vintage game is displayed in emulation today. So shot from the CRT screen, because also the gamers were playing with the old tubes TVs, on the CRT it would look like this, and this is the digital emulation on the screen. So somehow the whole structure of the image is different, and also they're complaining the colors don't match. And this is kind of goes into your subject. So how we transfer colors from one medium to the other so they will actually look the same. And also, naturally, also displaying historical films in digital cinema today, there's the question, okay, is what we're seeing really what they saw at the time? And there's many aspects to that, a lot of aspects, but color is one of them. Another thing about the terminology, if you have analog or a digital video and you put it onto hard disk, these are two different processes. When you have an analog tape, you digitize it and you go from an analog to a digital signal. But when you put a digital tape onto a disk, it's not, people say, I digitized my DV tapes. But you didn't digitize them, you just ingest the information. So also kind of a terminology thing. What you say at home, I don't care, but in a professional context, you should make the difference between digitization and ingest. Ingest, you do already digital information, you put them on a hard disk, and digitization is clear, you go from analog to a digital signal. And ingest may also refer to, there are ways to kind of put this DV signal identically onto a hard disk, so you don't win or lose anything, so you don't do a transcoding with some other digital tapes. It's not so easy, and you have to go through a transcoding process, which we are also going to look into it. So the digital video signal, what is the basic structure of it? So basically you have image information and you have a soundtrack. Often we tend to forget that there's also sound in the AV file. And there is a header. And in the header is technical metadata. And we're going to see more about this technical metadata and how important it is. You can, in certain cases, also attach other metadata to the package and you all wrap it in a container. So we have different aspects of an audiovisual file. We have the codec of the image. This may be MPEG-4, MPEG-2, whatever, H.264, however they call it. So that's the compression, or it may be uncompressed, which is usually called V210. Don't ask me why. And we have a soundtrack, which is yet in another compressed or uncompressed codec. Then we have metadata, which may or may not be attached in an XML format usually. And the container format is yet another format, which is the one you usually see. You see, it's an AVI, or it's a QuickTime. But actually, this is deceiving, because inside an AVI can be two totally different qualities or codecs. So when you deal with this kind of digital files, you are interested to know not just what is the container. Yeah? Yeah, so let me quickly jump to that. So MP4 is the container which was conceived solely for MPEG-4. So if you have an MP4 container, this can only hold an MP4 file. But an AVI container can hold an MP4, can hold uncompressed, can hold this and that. So containers have different abilities to hold certain codecs, and some containers are very narrow, like the MP4, and other containers are very flexible. And still, you have to make the difference. MP4 is the container. MPEG-4, also called AVC or H.264, this is the same, is the codec. So that's how the data is encoded. So there's kind of a different important difference in this. So what does it mean when we do transcoding, when we go from one codec to another? This can mean, it doesn't have to, that everything changes. So your video in your eye still looks the same. Maybe suddenly you can't play it on a certain player, but on another one you can. But you, initially you would probably say the video is the same, but on the information level it may be totally different. So you can change the codec of the image, you can change the codec of the soundtrack. Metadata may be attachable or not. You may lose it in the process. Suddenly it's not there anymore. So be aware with transcoding, because you can lose a lot of information, meaning lose a lot of quality in a thoughtless transcoding process. And there is this software I kind of recommend. This is open software where you can check what kind of coding. Now I need my glasses. I'm going to show you an example. So I'm taking one of these video files, if I ever manage to, and put them into the media info program. And this program is really just there to show you the metadata. So on one hand, it's the information in the header and some other metadata. So what do we find here? General, you have the format, which is MPEG-TS, which I'm not initially aware what that exactly is, but anyway, now we know. And you have the duration of the clip. Sorry, this is all in German. You have the size of your file, and you have the bit rate. So, how thick does your cable need to be to play this well? And so, do we have a laser pointer or something? Okay, I can use this. So things we kind of now identify: width 1080, yeah, width 920, height 1080. So this is HD. Aspect ratio 16:9, frequency 25 FPS. That means this is 1080p. So it's full HD, progressive. It's component video in YUV. Actually, this is funny. This should be CBCR, because YUV is analog. Anyway, it's luminance and chrominance separated. We have a color subsampling information. We have an information about the bit depth. We have the information that it's interlaced. Okay. That is a good one. So this is contradicting.
Because this is analog, isn't it?
No, interlace can also be in the digital world. So there are interlaced digital formats, but it cannot be, there should be 50i. So very interesting. So it can be contradicting. And then there you also know that a player which plays this file also reads this information. So what is the player going to do? Is it assuming it's interlaced, or is it assuming it's progressive? Anyway, there is a compression which is lossy, so it's not uncompressed, etc., etc. So here's information about the color space. So this is the Rec 709 for HD, so this kind of, I'm lucky, it makes sense. So, and lower down, you can see information about the audio, how many channels, two channels, sampling rate, etc., etc. So these tools are very, very useful to find out what you're dealing with. But as you've seen, the information that is written in here, also somebody at some point would define this, what is written here, and actually it may not be identical to what the video actually is. So it's very useful to have this meta information, but it can also mislead you. And there are a lot of points where it's kind of hard to say what it really means. So I can't make sense of all of these points. But you can find those which are interesting to you, and then you can make use of this information. So in short, there are tools which help you on one hand to make conversions, to make transcoding, like this FFmpeg software, and there are tools just for analysis. And I'm kind of promoting these because they're open, so they're free, and they are supported by a community which is, I think, a very good community, and also for archives, these are excellent resources. So quickly talking about digital compression. So the aim of digital compression is to save data. That's the basic thing. And as we have seen in the analog world, there were already similar strategies, which are then also used in the digital world. And they are naturally new strategies. And generally, the compression tries to make use of the tolerance our vision has. Sometimes our eye is very precise, sometimes it's very tolerant. And just first off, there is this color subsampling. And actually, I don't know if we have really time to go into it, but color subsampling, interesting, is a way of compressing data, but usually it's mentioned separately.
We have approximately 5 more minutes.
Okay, I think I can make it. Yeah, okay. I think I can make it. So we've seen that the image is split into luminance and chrominance, with this YUV or YCBCR. And what you do in color subsampling is just you discard every second vertical line of your color information. Because your eyes, the sharpness you see in an image is much more defined by the luminance than by the color part of the image. That's why they said, okay, we just throw away half of the color information and it will still look the same. And it works surprisingly good. That means you throw away a third of your information, but it still looks more or less the same. So this is very effective, and this has been is called color subsampling. And there are... If you look at here at the list of video formats, here they write, okay, the compression is this and that, and the sampling ratio is mentioned separately, as I said, even though, in my opinion, it's also just the compression. But just that you know, it's kind of something that is a separate information. And if you There are various ways which are further than these called 422. There is 411, 420. And if you want to know more, there is a white paper by Charles Poynton, which explains it in detail, but I'm not going into details. So again, also this color sampling is kind of anticipated in the analog world with this composite signal, and there are several aspects in the modern audiovisual video that go back to the heritage of the analog video. So this focus on the vertical resolution, this kind of how many lines are there, and the basic resolution we use as a standard for SD video, it all goes back to the good old days. This interlaced scan, the fact that there is an interlaced and a progressive version also goes back to the history of video. And the fact that in the US, the video doesn't run at 60 frames per second, but at 59.97 is also a historical fact. And I can't explain it to you. I think somebody explained it to me once. I immediately forgot it. But it's just take it as a fact. It's not 60, it's almost 60. And in most cases, you just talk of 60, but this is also heritage of the analog video world. And the fact that we are dealing with non-square pixels is also based already in the analog world. So quickly about compression, I don't know if that is something you know about. There are certain ways to compress images. You can compress images without a loss. If you have a big area in an image which is already the same, you can pack this together and say, okay, all of these dots are black and you don't need to define it dot by dot. So you can already save data by packing areas together which are the same, which would be lossless compression. And then generally we make a difference between intra-frame and inter-frame compression. And intra-frame compression is when every individual image is compressed, but it still stands every image for itself. And inter-frame compression, also referring to GOP, group of pictures, is a compression which works over a series of images. And what you're seeing here is a typical artifact of group of pictures compression. Some people also make art with this. It's called data moshing, so this may be interesting for you if you want to start to be an artist. But this is kind of, I'm sure you've seen artifacts like this, and this is due to group of picture interframe compression. And basically it works like this. In the regular video image, you have a series of images, and every image is stored individually. With the group of picture compression, you store one image completely, and then a whole series of images is stored, only the difference between image A and B. So if you have a background which is always the same, you will store it once in the I frame, and then in these P and B frames, you just store the difference you have between the I frame and your current frame. And naturally, like this, if an image is totally static, you store one frame and display the same frame X times, so you can save a huge amount of information. And there are details about this. The B and the P frame is about to what image actually this B frame refers to the I frame, but the P frame refers to something else. So in detail, it gets very complex, but basically the system is you take one image completely and then you take the difference for a certain amount of frames. And if something goes wrong with the I frame, suddenly it doesn't know how to put together the next frames, and then you have effects like this. And then there's also different ways to compress an image. So the classic JPEG compression we still today, if you apply it in a really strong way, like you reduce the size of the image to 5%, you get something like this, and you can still see something, but it's not so great. And there are other strategies, which is the JPEG 2000 compression, which I'm not going to explain in detail, but it uses strategies that you can go even to 3% of the size, and it still looks better than the other compression. So in compression, there are different strategies you can go down, and depending on what digital video format you're using, it either only uses intraframe or interframe, etc., etc. So we are in a field where there's a lot of variation in the technique of compression, which then it defines the codec part of the image.
Okay.
That's it. I'm done. You just wanted to interrupt me, right?
Yeah,
but I'm done.
Exactly. So, no, very exciting, very interesting topic and presentation. Are there any questions? No questions? Okay, due to the limited time, I think just say thank you, David. For your very exciting, lively presentation, a lot of analog material, and hope to see you back next year.
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Good. Okay, let's take a lunch break, and we continue for the conference.
Just made it in time.
Because you did it to dive here. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what, that was the minimum. That's right, the right slide. Yeah.
And so now there's 15 minutes.
Okay. I need to do this.
You wanna maybe we can read these things, yeah.
Aha, okay. Is it not defined where it's happening? Is column?
No, no, it is defined. It's not here.
Oh, it's not here, so we have to order.
Yeah. But, what do you think? We want to quickly pack everything?
Well, maybe.
But I bring you a cup of chocolate.
Or water or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was very lucky that almost immediately after leaving the university, I got a job in post-production. So it was really like coming together on a very lucky strike.
So although your academic background was related to the job that you
The thing is, naturally, at the side, next to my PhD, I did a lot of things already. I worked in the cinema, and I had experiences more in the analog cinema world, not so much in the video world. And I was also lucky enough, my boss, the guy who would become my boss, was actually also a chemist. And he was also coming so from the natural science side, so in a way it was kind of a good match. So there's a bit of luck involved. But I must say still now, I mean, I've been working many years, but I have no fixed employment at the university. I'm a freelancer, so kind of finding your way and getting jobs, naturally it gets a bit easier because people start to know your name. Also, Switzerland is a relatively small country, but
the measurement
it is always a bit it's not like you go off to university, you find a job, and then after 30 years you go into pension. It's a different challenge. But it's what I've picked.
It's easy for me to hear that you just left all the PhDs, because when you study PhDs, okay, this is the path that you choose.
This is the last step, exactly.
Yeah. No, but I mean, that is the reason why I finished the PhD. I thought, I'm not going to school and university for, I don't know, 10 years, 15, 20 years, and then leave just before I finish my PhD. So I kind of said, okay, I finish it, but then I can do what I want. And, you know, the fact that I picked, naturally, I'm interested in natural science and all these things, but the fact that I picked the chemistry thing and everything was kind of, how to say, it was due to also what my dad wanted and stuff like that. So it's I was fulfilling the dream of my dad, making a PhD, and then at some point I could say, okay, I can let that go. And interestingly, since I left my the academic route, so to say, my dad doesn't really know what I'm doing professionally. He was halfway didn't get it, halfway wasn't interested. So sometimes it's also connected to these things, the way you go.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye.
So I think that should be possible. I'm still in the gamut set. I am a little bit up, so.
Ihr habt es ins Handgepäck genommen und dann haben sie ganz genau schauen müssen, was ich da dabei habe. Aber das ist schon But it's not even electronic devices. You know, it's really nothing. It's just weird, but not really.
And you saw the image.
Image
on the screen of the with all these rings.
And the person was kind of, what the hell is that? Das ist der Hammer, oder? Das habe ich auch erst kürzlich. Und das funktioniert irgendwie kapazitiv, also das ist nochmal ganz anders. Das ist nicht ein optischer Disk, sondern irgendwie eben mit so einem magnetischen Stylus.
Ja.
I first said CGI insects.
Computer generated.
Okay.
No, no.
What kind of imagination do you have?
I would have never read that. The decent mind doesn't.
Yeah.
But you go around, you know, to these what do you call these flea markets. You still find a lot of these gadgets on flea markets, isn't it?
I must say,